Welcome to the second episode of Connection Point. Today's episode is all focused on litigation. Several years ago, AILA formed the Administrative Litigation Task Force, and we had really two purposes in doing that: educating and enabling more AILA members to litigate on their own individually, but also to develop and file AILA's own impact litigation for the benefit of our members and to uplift immigration practice in general. And we've had great results in our own litigation efforts as an association, challenging policies like the visa bans, the public charge rule, the prevailing wage rule, and the USCIS fee rule. And those are just some examples. You can read more about that great work on our website. It's all there. But today, I really wanted to highlight just a few victories of individual AILA members who are out there every day, zealously advocating for their clients in federal court and winning, because I find those stories so inspiring and they make such a big difference. So I want to introduce you to Tony Drago from the New England chapter and Lisa Kasdan from the New Jersey chapter. And they're going to talk about some of their recent court victories. I hope that you're going to find their stories as inspiring and motivational as I do. Tony, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me today. It's really great to see you, so as virtually though it is. I definitely know you from your past involvement with AILA and on various committees and serving as an elected director on the Board of Governors, but I was less familiar with your recent litigation victories. And I'm really glad we get a chance to talk about that a little bit today. Your cases involved TPS holders seeking adjustment of status, which I know is a fact pattern that is pretty common for a lot of our AILA members dealing with. And there have been a number of cases around this issue of adjusting status after you've obtained TPS. But the situational facts and the legal arguments are a little bit different in the various cases and the decisions that have come down so far. Can you sort of situate your own case within the context of those other cases and just walk us through the various issues that are related to TPS holders seeking to adjust?
Absolutely, Jennifer. The TPS cases have been very interesting for me. It's been an area that I've been involved in for quite some time. So I'll just lay out really the three scenarios that have been going on across the country. Okay, the first one is the one that's getting the most publicity right now, and that's a case that was argued at the Supreme Court. And that are people who came into the United States without inspection and never left, got TPS, and then they tried to adjust their status based upon the claim that the grant of TPS is a deemed admission into the United States, and therefore they could adjust their status under Section 245A because they had been admitted to the United States. So that's one distinct set of cases. The Supreme Court is going to decide that, I think very soon, in the Sanchez case, and that will let us know whether or not these people who came without inspection can actually adjust status here in the States. That's not my case. The second set of cases are people who had come into the United States without inspection, been granted TPS, and traveled with advanced parole, never placed in removal proceedings though. And there are ongoing issues with those. My case involved the third scenario, which was people who came without inspection, were granted temporary protected status, but they traveled with advanced parole. But after they came into the United States, they were put into proceedings. And most of the people that I represented had been ordered removed. So they were subject to an order of removal, they got TPS, traveled with advanced parole, came back into the United States, and then applied for adjustment of status before the USCIS based upon an immediate relative petition. And that's the case that I got very much involved with, cases that I had been doing for years without problems until last year. And then all of a sudden we start getting into the litigation, which we'll talk about.
Great. So that's good background. Thank you, Ed, because there are really distinct but related issues surrounding this whole issue of people being eligible to adjust. In your case, your clients filed for adjustment and were denied and then came to you and you sued in federal court. Can you give us more about the specific legal arguments that were made in your case?
Sure. These were people I've been working with for a long time, Jennifer. You have TPS recipients from Haiti, Honduras, and El Salvador, all who had TPS for years. And so I had been doing adjustment cases for their family members. And then lo and behold, We go into the USCIS, and last year, the pandemic breaks out in March, and I'm sitting in my office, and I got five denials within a 1 or 2 week period, I think it was. And the USCIS decided at that point in time that it did not have jurisdiction over those adjustment applications because these people had been in proceedings in the past. And the claim was that only EOIR had jurisdiction over the adjustment. And then they made a further claim that the adjustments, not only did they have to take place at EOIR, but our legal challenge to them in litigation was an attempt to try and attack the removal orders, and that the court didn't have jurisdiction over that because of the jurisdictional stripping statutes, which we know about, where you have to take a case to the Circuit Court of Appeals. So those were things that they framed in the litigation. In terms of the CIS, it all just started with them saying, we don't have jurisdiction. And the reason we don't have jurisdiction is because you came into the United States without inspection. You are not an arriving alien. And therefore, only EOIR has jurisdiction over the case. So they either denied the applications to adjust status, or they administratively closed them. Once we got those decisions, we challenged those cases under the Administrative Procedures Act in federal court.
So walk me, obviously the district court agreed with you and your arguments. Tell me what your arguments were and what the court's rationale was in its decision.
The argument for me was real simple. When I'm litigating, I try to narrow in on what I think is going to help me win. And really for me, the starting and the ending point was people who travel with advanced parole are arriving aliens. Arriving aliens adjust their status with the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services. I can't say it any other way. The government tried to say, look, there's this statute called MTINA. It was a miscellaneous technical correction statute that came out in 1991. So before IRA-IRA and all that stuff. And what that statute did was really try to protect people with TPS. It tried to protect their continuous physical presence. And it says that if you have TPS and you leave the country with TPS, you return to the United States in the same status, okay? So that's the wording that really started getting hung up in the litigation. So the USCIS and the United States Attorney's Office, that's who litigated these cases. It wasn't the oil group, it was the US attorneys. They came into the court and they said, well, you left the United States. When you left the United States, you had entered the country without inspection and been subject to an order of removal. And when you left, you came back without inspection, subject to an order of removal. That was their legal argument. And then they added in the jurisdictional framing argument that said, well, the court doesn't have jurisdiction over this because they're trying to attack a removal order and you can't adjudicate a case like that, right? So they used two ways to attack us, where I just held fast and said, okay, you must be crazy. How is it that a person leaves the United States with explicit permission to reenter this country, gets inspected at our borders, has a CBP officer review their advance parole document, and then parole them into the United States, specifically on the advance parole document that says you are returning to this country to resume your TPS status? So the fight was, what does that advanced parole mean? What happens at the border? And does it have any real legal meaning, right? To me, I think to us as immigration people, I don't see that we can look at it any other way than saying an advanced parole is a parole document. And when you come into the United States as a parolee, you are an arriving alien. And I stayed very much steadfast on that point and litigated that point. That was really what I kept saying. Parole is parole. And a parolee is an arriving alien. And we drilled that home to the court. And so the judge, in her decision, ordered the USCIS to accept jurisdiction over these applications to adjust status and to adjudicate them. Unfortunately, Jennifer, last Friday was the 60th day for the appeal, and the government did file an appeal in the First Circuit. And so now I'm going to be back to the drawing board, briefing issues. But the beauty in this particular part of the process is I'm going in with a win. and hopefully will prevail. And at least then in the First Circuit, we'll have a precedent decision that'll make a big difference for a lot of people.
Yes, and potentially teeing up an eventual Supreme Court case if there's a contrary decision from another circuit in future on this narrow set of facts that you're talking about with a person who's in removal proceedings and then, you know, re-entering on parole and seeking to adjust. So I'm going to think positively, Tony, and say that we're about to get a really favorable precedent at the First Circuit that can be applied outside of the District of Massachusetts. But tell me right now, what I'm understanding on the ground is that the USCIS adjudicating officers at the Boston field office are following this decision and approving adjustments for people in your client's situation. Is that correct?
It's been very inconsistent, Jennifer. We are getting reports of some people getting approved, but not everyone. And so we're just going to have to continue going through this process and trying to get things straightened out. But as of yet, they are not consistently approving cases.
So as usual, the only consistency is inconsistency with USCIS. That hasn't changed.
That's true. Inconsistent and constant change, for sure. That's still going on.
Ayla has a lot of support available for members who want to litigate and maybe a little bit timid or afraid about that. We have a lot of mentoring available. We have a lot of free resources available on the Ayla website that are put together by the Administrative Litigation Task Force, including a whole host of sample pleadings and briefings that are really helpful to people who are kind of hesitant litigators, but who know that that's what they need to do to get the right result for their clients, like Tony did. So please check those out if you haven't already at Ayla.org. Welcome back, everyone, and thanks for joining us for my second interview. This one is with Lisa Kasdan from the New Jersey chapter. I'm very excited to meet you, Lisa. This is the first time I've met you virtually or otherwise. So can you start maybe just by telling me a little bit about your practice and what areas of focus you have and how long you've been doing this kind of work?
Sure, absolutely. I started practicing immigration law as a lawyer about 7 years ago, and I joined my mother's practice, the law office of Marcia Kasdan. Before that, I was over the years a paralegal. You know, I was her daughter. So of course I did some summer intern work, but I didn't think I was going to be a lawyer. And then once I went to law school, I knew that I ultimately wanted to pursue immigration with her. So I joined her practice, and we focus on litigation, family immigration. We basically do everything except business immigration. So we're in court constantly. We work with USCIS a lot. We do U visas. And a lot of my work focuses on the criminal immigration overlap, which people like to call crimmigration. And I do a lot of the detained work, but we do much more non-detained work, but all defensive removal.
Interesting. So I too was an immigration paralegal before I went to law school, but in business immigration. And so I've never focused on removal defense, but otherwise similar trajectories. I've also never practiced law with my mother, which is, that's really cool that you get to do that. So speaking of that, your firm had an important victory at the Third Circuit last year that affirmed the Supreme Court's decision in Pereira. And I understand that case was actually argued by your mother, Marcia, who practices with you. But can you tell us a little bit about the legal arguments in that case and the holding?
Absolutely. As a side note, working with my mother is a treat. You know, not everyone, you know, is excited to hear when I work with a parent, but it's nothing but great. So I'm very lucky. She did argue this. This was our client was Wilson Guadalupe. So the case was Wilson Guadalupe versus AG in the Third Circuit. It was argued in late December 2019, and it was based on the fact that our client had a defective NTA. And this was a post-Pereira case. And so we used that Pereira case in order to further make our argument that the later notice to appear in court did not cure the defect in the initial NTA. And the case that was sort of standing in our way prior to Pereira was a Third Circuit case that came down in 2016 called Orozco Velasquez. And that case said that even if an NTA is defective on its face, meaning it doesn't have the time or place noted, it can be cured by a later notice of hearing if it's sent to the respondent. But then Pereira, the Supreme Court, said otherwise. So we use that to hopefully abrogate the Third Circuit's decision in the Orozco Velasquez case. And that is what happened. We were successful in doing so, which was very exciting because It helps so many people. And just last week, Ms. Chavez came down in the Supreme Court, which further supported this decision and further emphasized everything that we argued. So this was a very exciting decision, and it did come out in 2020, which we needed a little boost in 2020. So it was exciting for us and many of our colleagues.
Yeah, and just a shout out to those of you who have not yet read this most recent Supreme Court decision. There's a lot of really fantastic language in there from the majority opinion from Gorsuch that is really just, it's like birthday cake for immigration lawyers. So definitely read it if you haven't. It's a real kick. So are there any other cases or, you know, particularly impactful cases, either for your clients or for you or for the practice of immigration law that really stick out in your mind that you want to mention as you're talking to other ALA members about why it's so great to litigate?
Yes, for sure. We've had some exciting times in the Third Circuit. We're not always lucky. You can't always be lucky. You can't always win. But when you do, it's really exciting because of the impact it has, not only for your client, but for so, so many others. There are two other cases I'd like to discuss where we were successful. And the first one I'm going to discuss is another case that Marcia Kasdan argued before the Third Circuit, and that was Flores v. Attorney General, and that was in 2017. The issue was determining if our client actually had a particularly serious crime, which would render her ineligible to apply for withholding of removal. As a side, she was convicted of accessory after the fact, which is witnessing and failing to report a murder. And that happened in South Carolina. So when we attempted to do this case before the immigration judge, it was denied. At the BIA level, it was also denied, holding that this was in fact a particularly serious crime. And when Marcia argued before the Third Circuit, they determined that this was not an offense that related to obstruction of justice or an aggravated felony under the INA. We were able to determine that she was in fact eligible for withholding of removal. The hard part about this case is that this client had been detained and she was removed from the country during the pendency of this Third Circuit litigation because there was no way to definitively hold her in detention during the Third Circuit case. So when we won, it took quite a while to get her back, but we were able to bring her back and ultimately she won her case and she's a permanent resident today. And more recently, which is a very proud moment, not just for our office, but for me personally, I had my first argument before the Third Circuit in February 2020, sort of before the world changed. So I was in front of them. And I argued a case called Francisco Lopez versus Attorney General. And the issue of that case was if the theft CIMT definition that was changed in 2016 under a BIA case, matter of Diaz-Lizarraga, could in fact be applied retroactively. So the theft CIMT definition was changed in 2016 to say the crime that my client committed was now a theft CIMT, but it wasn't when he committed his crime in 2012. You know, my client was detained for over 2 years. I attempted to terminate the case before the judge based on a Second Circuit decision, which was nearly identical to this, because he was from New York. He lived in New York basically his entire time living in the United States, and his crime appeared in New York, and he was only detained in New Jersey because of space issues in ICE detention. So I attempted to terminate it based on this my argument that you couldn't retroactively apply, but because he was seated in the Third Circuit, they didn't weigh the Second Circuit's decision. We then lost our 42A case for him because he was a permanent resident. He remained detained. We attempted to appeal to the BIA, still no luck. And then we brought it to the Third Circuit, and also another 2020 decision is that that new definition from Diaz-Lizarraga cannot be retroactively applied. So that was really, really exciting. Again, not just for our own client who finally was able to return to his family after over 2 years of detention, but also for so many people. You know, I hear every day of someone using that case.
That's a fantastic story. Thank you. I feel like it's so important for people to understand that, you know, even a little tiny stone, when you throw it into a big pool, can have such a huge ripple effect. And you're absolutely right that these individual litigation actions, and when we get positive results and good precedent, that it lifts everybody and helps everyone else who comes along behind you. So congratulations on all of your success. I guess I would just ask in closing, you know, for people who maybe understand that litigation is the only avenue to get to the right result for their clients, but who are not habitual litigators or just kind of afraid of it, what's your best advice for people who are just starting out trying to dip their toes into the pool of litigation?
So I think there's room for everyone to dip their toe in, and you could dip it in just a touch, or you could dip it in all the way. As an aside, I'm an immigration attorney by day, but I'm a singer, and I sing professionally. I give voice lessons, and nobody thought I would ever go to law school. So it's not that I'm this like born and raised litigator. Okay. I'm a singer who likes to do this. And I think if the passion is there, that's all you need. If you want to try, you need to try. And there are so many groups and so many avenues that you could include yourself in to feel more comfortable. There are mentors, there are Facebook groups, there are listservs, there are so many ways to get involved in whatever capacity you choose to. And look, even though I'm a performer, you know, going before the Third Circuit was a big deal to sit, you know, to look up, to see these judges, you know, judging you and every word that you articulate, and hundreds of clerks is what it felt like watching you. It's real, and it's nerve-wracking, and it's scary, no doubt, for anybody, but everyone's willing to help and everyone's looking for you to succeed, because it helps everyone. And we all have that same passion that joins us, which is why we do what we do.
Well, thank you, Lisa. Thank you so much for your time and for being such an inspirational part of the ALA community. I'm really glad I got to meet you today, and good luck to you in your continued practice. And that's a wrap for this episode. Don't miss our next edition, where I will be talking to ALA's incoming president, our current president-elect, Alan Orr, just in time for the annual conference. Until next time, stay happy, safe, and well, ALA community.